The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and this is Film Weekly, coming to you from the Edinburgh International Film Festival. We're at the Film House, the spiritual heart and buzz of this festival in its new June slot. We'll be bringing you the stars and characters of the festival. We'll be meeting legendary special effects innovator Ray Harryhausen.
They weren't monsters, they were creatures, misunderstood creatures.
Not content with being hot in Hollywood and on the London stage, Chiwetel Ejiofor debuts here as a director with short film Slapper.
Initially I was quite stressed. I was a stressed director, I think, more than anything else.
We'll be meeting Brazilian director and Berlin winner José Padilla, and we'll find out what the festival means for an up-and-coming filmmaker in her hometown.
It's brilliant. It's fantastic. Yeah. Creates a buzz around the city, and Edinburgh's always been a heart for festivals.
But first, being jury president at an international film festival always looks like the plum job. And after meeting this year's jury president, actor Danny Houston, I'm even more convinced it's the sweetest gig in town, apart from my own, of course. I caught up with Danny, son of the unforgettable John Houston, as he reclined in the lobby of the plush Caledonian Hotel. And I started out by asking him if he'd enjoyed the experience of being the big boss, head of the jury. So you were looking over for the Michael Powell Award, obviously an illustrious British filmmaker. It's been named after rather like your father, I suppose. They were of the same sort of era, very different people, obviously, but they're of the great tradition of British film. What's the state of British film that you've seen there up there this week, Danny? All right, so that was a kind of law that you set down, that as president, rather like yourself, Danny, you're looking for visionary and maverick rather than perfect. It's very interesting. I think you look over these films, and they're, you know, I'd say they're probably what we used to call indie films in a way. They're not big studio movies. They're not big, as you say, polished products. And you've spent quite a lot of time yourself working in a mixture of both of those things. You've done some very low budget kind of indie movies, and you still are doing them. I think of Ivan's Ecstasy, for example, and you're back there in Edinburgh this year with another Bernard Rose movie, The Kreutzer Sonata. Again, a sort of reasonably low budget, but you've managed to mix those with the big budget, the Marie Antoinette and the kind of more Hollywood work that you do. Do you have a preference for which one you throw yourself into? What do you think your father would have made of the independent spirited films, these low budget works? Now, tell us about the Kreutzer Sonata that you're up there in Edinburgh with. I haven't had a chance to catch up with it yet, but I know it's by Bernard Rose, whom, as I mentioned earlier, you did Ivan's Ecstasy with, a film that really, I suppose, brought you to the attention of many people as an actor. It's a funny old job, acting, isn't it? Have you got over the fact that your father actually wasn't God in the end as well? He was a big Edinburgh Festival fan as well, wasn't he? He was president of the jury himself. Now, as we heard there, Danny Houston was a director who fell into acting. Well, Chiwetel Ejiofor is an actor who now finds himself in the director's chair for the first time as he debuts his short film Slapper in the Edinburgh Festival. Slapper is a strange and oddly compelling film about a boy and his father. And my apologies if I'm being a bit general, but to say anything more about it would be to give too much away. So I met up with Chiwetel to talk about his new film experience.
It was great. It's been very exciting to come up here and show the film here. It's a terrific festival, and it was great to be just around people who are enthusiastic for film, and they were eager to see all the shorts that were shown yesterday, and it was a really great time.
Directing your first film, you wrote it as well. It's called Slapper. I don't want to give too much away because it's a film that, like all good shorts, it kind of delays its punchline until you realise what's happening. Was that the idea when you knew you were approaching making a short?
Yeah, I wanted to do a short that had a really strong narrative sense, a really strong storyline, and then like you say, just didn't reveal everything at once, and was something that could draw an audience in and be pretty intriguing, hopefully. So that's what, you know, I went about in the narrative, and I also wanted to tell a story that was that was sort of touching as well in some ways.
Yeah, because it's funny and it's dramatic and it's about fathers and sons.
Yeah, so everybody needs a hero.
Yeah, how do you go around pitching it? Do you give away the punchline? I don't, you know, I'm being nice to you. I'm not telling people what it's about.
Sure, that's good. Yeah, thank you. You don't want to give too much away, but if you're trying to pitch it in terms of get money, I think you have to reveal a few things. So in terms of that, you know, before I wrote it, when I was going around just trying to get some, raise some financing for it, I was, I told the whole thing in all its conceptual glory.
Right, but am I right in keeping it quiet? I'm not allowed to say what it's about.
Yeah, I think it's best actually. I think it's best to sort of let an audience, see it. And, that was great about sort of yesterday. It's just the audience's reactions to it were so. Completely off the cuff, because nobody knew what was coming next. Yes. And that was really exciting. It's really great to see.
I mean, obviously for you, as a well-known actor who's actually, film by film, getting bigger and bigger, which is a great pleasure to see, I've got to tell you. You managed to get in some good mates, obviously, to help you. When you get Bill Nighy, you get Ian Glen, you get even Kerry Mulligan in a little role. How do you feel that when you see the rest of the kind of the people you're in the competition with using unknowns? And did you think maybe I shouldn't have called on my mates?
No, I mean, my film is quite heightened in many ways, and the storyline. And it really lent itself to some of the kind of bigger names, if you like, that are around and about and in my film. So I don't think it was a sort of, irresponsible name drop, I think it does fit the mode, the mood of the piece. And so that's what I was kind of excited about. I mean, Bill's character especially. And so that's why I asked Bill to do it, really. It seemed like it really worked. And there are people in the film who are, Nathaniel Gleed, who's the young boy who's basically the protagonist of the piece, is, he's an unknown actor. I mean, he has done bits and pieces before, but, he's fairly unknown. So that was exciting. That was just a great mix of talent and experience in the film.
And is your first time directing? Was it literally the first time you'd actually kind of got on set and thought, blimey, I'm the director now, what do I do?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was the first time really that I had directed anything. So I was the person with, I was the only person on set who'd never really done the job before.
Did you find you were a shouty director? Were you a kind of cajoler of performances, a smooth operator? Or did you find that kind of the power and the pace of it brought out a different side of you that you hadn't seen?
I think, initially I was quite stressed. I was a stressed director, I think, more than anything else. Panicked and worried director. I never turned into a shouty director, thankfully, I think.
Do you think that now, the next time you go back on set to be an actor in a movie, you're going to have a little bit more empathy and sympathy for the crew and the director that... I'm sure you always did have that, but a little bit more understanding of what on earth's going on.
Yeah, but the thing is, you've got to shut down that part of your brain. Even all the stuff that I know, in terms of having made a film, and it just won't come into play, I don't think, when I act.
Yeah, I'm not saying you're going to start bossing Spike Lee around and saying, you know what you're doing.
Yeah, change the lights over here, because this is completely wrong. No, I know you don't mean that. I just feel like it's it's a very specific job, acting, right. and you can't really pay too much attention to anything else that's going on. You really have to focus on what you're doing, and it takes all the energy you have, really.
Where can we see you next acting?
Well, I've just finished doing Pete Travis's film in South Africa called Endgame. I play Thabo Mbeki. It's about the end of apartheid in the late 80s.
Yeah, wonderful.
It was a really terrific experience, and we shot most of it in the UK, which is where Mbeki was for a while he was in exile. And then we shot in South Africa in Cape Town as well. So, a really great experience.
Yeah, that sounds like one to be really proud of.
Yeah, it was a really terrific film, a great script, a great part, and a really good cast and a really terrific director. So, very happy.
And that's just been shot, so that's being made right now.
Yeah, so that's just that's actually being edited, and will be around, I suppose, sometime next year.
And even after your little Hollywood stints, because they came quite thick and fast at the end of last year, what with Talk to Me and with the Spike Lee movie Inside Man, it was really building out there for you. It was really exciting to see you in American movies. But we haven't lost you, because you're clearly here and making films here and being in Edinburgh.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I've been very fortunate to be able to make films in America and work with some really terrific people out there. But I'm thrilled about being here. I want to carry on making films in the UK and hopefully more than that. So that's sort of why I'm here and why I did what I've done here and the short and everything. And so There we are.
Cheers, Joel. Lovely to see you. Congratulations.
And you. Thanks. Thanks, Chris.
Well, there's certainly a buzz around the Edinburgh International Film Festival, and here at the Film House, the spiritual centre of the festival, which is spread around the city's cinema. We've just heard from Chiwetel Ejiofor about the challenges of short filmmaking, and I'm joined now by another young director working in the short film form, Andrea Harkin. Welcome to Film Weekly, Andrea.
Thank you.
Your film plays in the Scottish Short Film Showcase. It's called The Flyer. It's set here in Edinburgh, and you're based here in Edinburgh as well, which is probably the best place to show it is at the Edinburgh Festival then.
Yeah, it was a lovely surprise to learn that the film was selected for the Scottish Short Film Showcase alongside another three short films. And yeah, it's brilliant to be here in Edinburgh and get to enjoy the full festival as well.
Because you live and work here, don't you?
I do, yeah.
I've been how long have you been here?
I've been here for about 9 years, yeah. Originally from Northern Ireland and came over to go to university in 99 and stayed on, studied and loved the city.
So is there a short film scene here in Edinburgh as well?
Yeah, there is. There's the Screen Academy Scotland with neighbour university and Edinburgh College of Art, so there's plenty of master's students and undergraduate students producing films, and there's also plenty of independent producers and filmmakers actually in the Scottish Short Film Showcase. All four films there have been made by non-students and people who've kind of produced their films independently and not through a scheme or whatever, so there's a good scene, yeah.
What does it mean for somebody like you who lives and works in Edinburgh to actually have an international film festival like this in your hometown?
It's brilliant, it's fantastic. Yeah. It creates a buzz around the city, and Edinburgh's always been a heart for festivals, as you know. So it's something to aim towards as well, you know, being here and feeling the buzz, and you can attend the festival even if you don't have a film in it. So it's a good aspiration to try and get a film in it, so it's great, yeah.
Well, you did that. Congratulations on that. Tell me a bit about The Flyer, because it's about a Polish immigrant.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's about a Polish girl called Anna who moves to try and start a new life in Scotland, and she's having some relationship problems back home with her boyfriend who's remained in Poland, and she's just kind of at a juncture in her life and trying to decide whether she should stay in Edinburgh or go back home. So it's kind of a love story with some contemporary relevance as well.
So, I mean, those sort of stories as well, it's all very well living and working in a scene here, but you need to have stories here. Does Edinburgh give you that kind of rich tapestry of human life?
It does, yeah. I mean, it's a fairly small city, so yeah, you know, it's got a kind of large villagey type feel to it, which is nice. And yeah, you do kind of, for me, the inspiration for The Flyer was obviously, you know, the growing Polish population in Scotland, which is, you know, really prevalent. And maybe you would notice it up here. I mean, you notice it all over the UK because Edinburgh's small. You get to know Polish people, you know, quite easily, and so that was inspirational.
Your film's already had some success. I mean, I know it's premiering here in it's gone on a Friday night at the showcase, but it's already had some quite good success, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. The production company Pilton Video put it in for the BAFTA Scotland New Talent Awards back in March, and Alexandra Coachella, who's the lead actress, won the BAFTA Scotland Award for Best First-Time Performance, and the script. I was nominated for a script as well, so it's been great to get that recognition.
All right, well, you hardly need the exposure of a festival or Film Weekly, but I hope we're good for you as well. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for coming on Film Weekly. Love to see you.
Thanks for having me.
It seems to me that in 2008, no film festival in the world is complete without another talented Brazilian filmmaker making the headlines, and Edinburgh is no exception. José Padilla is a documentary filmmaker from Rio de Janeiro, best known so far for his documentary Bus 174, a gritty piece about police incompetence surrounding a bus hijack in 2000. This time, José has turned to fiction to spotlight Rio de Janeiro's fearsome police force and the thin line they march between criminals and politicians. Elite Squad is violent and stylish and troubling, and it won the Golden Bear earlier this year in Berlin, so I just had to find out more. José Padilla, welcome to Film Weekly.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
And congratulations on your Golden Bear. I mean, great news for Brazilian film and for yourself.
It was quite a trip to Berlin, and it was very, very nice to win the Golden Bear. I mean, there are many great movies there. And also in the jury at the Berlin Film Festival was a personal hero of mine, Costa Gravas, who is a hero of all Latin American filmmakers for his political and socially critical movies he made in South America, so it was great.
Yeah, we were in Cannes as well, of course, where the Brazilian wave carried on with Fernando Meirelles and Walter Salles. There is a very strong movement at the moment coming from Brazil.
Yes, you know, we've been, the government has allowed us to do films for continuously for 20 years, first time in history, and we are getting the hang of it, I guess.
Well, I certainly, I mean, I loved your the documentary of yours that I saw, Bus 147, a wonderful story of Brazilian life, I suppose. But I was surprised to see where you went next with your with this, which is a much bigger budget and a much stronger fictional story.
Yes, you know, here's the thing. I tried to make Elite Squad as a documentary. It was supposed to be a companion piece to Bus 174. Because in Bus 174, what I tried to do is to kind of explain why small-time criminals became so violent in Brazil. And the answer is because the state itself treats them very badly since they are kids. And in Elite Squad, it's the same idea applied to the police. So my question was, why do we have such a violent and corrupted police? And why is it that we have cops like Captain Nascimento? And I started to try to do a documentary, but very soon I realized that I would get myself killed if I continue with this crazy idea. So I decided to write a screenplay instead. So,
you were actually scared of what the police, what the law would do to you?
Yeah, because the scenes that I would have to capture to convey what goes on with the police visually were not simply not doable. They wouldn't allow me to go there and film themselves torturing and killing people. And so I quickly realized they wouldn't even give me an interview without their faces covered. So it wasn't doable as a documentary, which is why I had the idea of, because I thought I needed to make that movie. So let's do a fictional movie. And I ended up writing a script with a cop. After 2 years of research and interviewing 20 cops and psychiatrists from the police, and all, to try to present the story of violence in Rio through the eyes of a violent cop.
What I admired most about your film, apart from the energy and colour and the strength of character, was that you never knew whose side to be on in a film, and that's quite unusual, I felt, morally. You don't know who the good guys and who the bad guys were, because I liked your central character, and yet he's a pawn of the state.
Right. I mean, we are all influenced by Hollywood being movie watchers, and in Hollywood, usually, not always, but usually, you know, the good guy is good all the way, and the bad guy is bad all the way, which makes all those movies unrealistic, because this is not how life is, and you know, people are good and bad at the same time. And my characters, I try to base them in reality, in real characters and in research, and they are like this. So you have, you know, in my movie, the narrator cares for his family, loves his wife, wants to take care of his kids. Meanwhile, he's in the slums, he is killing people, he's torturing, he's mean, and he's a terrible person. And this is what we find when we look at the real world in Brazil, and I try to make a movie that would reflect that. Furthermore, as a filmmaker, I don't like to tell the audience what to think. So, you know, I showed the main character torturing and killing people, innocent people, in favelas, and I don't think it's my, I don't think I have to say, listen, people in the audience, torture is a bad thing, because I think the audience is smart enough to make their own minds. So I try to present reality as itself, and I don't refrain from showing. I believe in Stanley Kubrick when he says that films should not be afraid of sex and violence, because those are the things you find in real life. They are very important in real life. They should be in the movies. We shouldn't shy away from them.
It does seem to me that talking to Brazilian filmmakers, to yourself, to Walter Salles, to Fernando Meirelles, and even the City of Men is coming out in the UK soon, Paulo Murillo, you all seem to have a very... you're very anxious to show your country in all its glory, in all its energy, in all its colour and vibrancy, but also in all its political problems. Do you feel there's a duty to do that? They're all very politically motivated. Even the human stories that Walter Salles tells, they're very humane, they're very about the social situation.
Well, I myself, I am a documentary filmmaker. foremost. And it's the tradition of documentary films to be socially critical. So if you go into documentaries to begin with, you have to go into this mind, unless you're doing like animal movies, which I've never done. But you know, so I always saw my movies as a way to make a statement, as a way to give back to society. Because here's the thing. If you look at street kids, and you know, when you live in a place like Rio, every time you run into street kids, poor people, and you find ways in order to survive not to notice them, you see, not to talk about them, not to put them in your minds all the time. And when you make a movie, all of a sudden people can talk about it, because the movie becomes an object which is somehow detached from reality, and then you can discuss it. So this is the magic of movie making, I think. And so it's a way to bring about subjects that are very close to us, but we fail to notice them, and to make them noticeable for debate. And this is how I see my movies. I don't know exactly how Walter and Fernando think about this, but the way I think about it, it's like this. It's...
Well, we're doing that now, and so it obviously worked. Thanks for coming to Edinburgh to start the discussion on with Tropa Nielic, and congratulations on the Berlin Golden Bear, and thanks for coming on Film Weekly to talk about it. José Padilla.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to talk to you guys, and I hope you like the movie.
Edinburgh may be a great festival for new talent, but it's also steeped in film history. We've moved upstairs in the film house to the hallowed grounds of the Edinburgh Film Guild, the world's longest continuous-running film society, and their spiritual home, a small, fusty screening room with about 25 seats in it, where gems from world cinema are unfurled regularly to a secret society. One of the great legends at the Edinburgh Film Festival enjoying a retrospective this year was Ray Harryhausen, the master of special effects, creator of films such as Sinbad, Gulliver and Jason and the Argonauts, which obviously has great personal resonance for myself. And those films are still held in high esteem and with great affection to this day, I think. To my delight, and just before he gave a great public audience, 88-year-old Ray Harryhausen granted an audience to me at Film Weekly, and we talked about his lifelong affair with the magic of film and about a few skeletons still rattling in his closet. I'm sitting on the rooftops of the Edinburgh International Film Festival. I've got the Arthur's Seat looming in the background, the Firth of Forth behind me. I've got Usher Hall, the modern Edinburgh stretches behind. But the real history is in front of me. A skeleton, the skeleton from Jason and the Argonauts is before me. And the man who made it, Ray Harryhausen, the legendary animator and model maker, is here. He's in person tonight at the Edinburgh Film Festival. Before that, he's come to speak to us at Observer Film Weekly. Ray Harryhausen, welcome. And thank you so much. What a pleasure to see you.
Thank you. Fine. Yes, this is one of seven skeletons. I have 3.5 in Berlin. I used the legs for one of the skeletons for something else. I've forgotten what. And they're in Berlin, but at the museum, at the Sony Museum. But I have two or three of them at home.
Well, I grew up... loving this creature, because Jason and the Argonauts, your film, was one of the only films that had my name in the title, Jason. So it was particularly close to me every time it was on television.
Here, I thought you were named after the film.
Well, I like to think I am, frankly.
Right.
It is a bit of film history in front of them. Just tell me a bit about, now we've got this chap here, where you made him and where you came up with him and where you sort of fabricated.
Well, in the original Greek mythology, rotting corpses come out of the ground, and we wanted to make a family picture and not one that would be have triple X's on it, you know, and then the kids couldn't even go to see it. And adults wouldn't like it. But today, you know, anything goes. But at the time our picture was made, there was heavy censorship. And I'll never forget when I first came over to England, even the Seventh Voyage had a skeleton in it, a nice clean-cut one, but they cut the whole sequence out because they said it would frighten children. And there's a print around somewhere where there's a lot of editing has gone on with the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. Right.
Well, this scared the life out of me, even though.
It's not supposed to scare you. You've got one inside of you.
But it comes out of the ground, Ray.
I know, but that's fantasy.
How did you actually shoot that? How tall is that? That's not very tall, that model.
No, but we shrink the people down to the size of the skeleton, right. Which makes them look like they're 6 feet high.
Right. Is it 10 inches or so?
8 inches, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you have seven of them on the screen, my process that I use, called Dynamation at the time, suggests that, there's a lot of rear projection involved. And to reproduce rear projection, you have to keep it in a certain size. Otherwise, you see the grain of the film. So that's one reason they're made at a small size, particularly when there's seven of them on the screen.
What's he made of?
He's made of metal. My father made him on a lathe, ball and socket joints. He has every joint that a real skeleton would have. Don't count the ribs. I just put a lot of ribs there because I didn't want to. Don't count them if you're an we don't make these pictures for professors and anatomists. They're made for entertainment, and I think people enjoyed seeing the skeletons fighting.
You said your father helped you make the models. So you commanded him to make it, and
well,
you were the creator.
Them, and then he made them on a lathe. Yes.
In your garage, wasn't it?
Section what?
In your garage at home.
At home in Los Angeles, yes. I was living in London. We made most of the picture in London, of course, and he would ship them over to me. I would design the armatures, and then he would make them on the lathe.
Why was it London that was the place that you made?
Well,
why the UK?
We made two pictures where we wanted to use the rank special process of traveling mat. Hollywood never paid much attention to traveling mat. They did use rear projection a great deal. And Gulliver wouldn't be the same if we used rear projection in it. So we decided to come over to England to use this special process of traveling mat.
Now, it's obvious that the people still hold the way you made your movies, they hold them very dear still, even in this age of extremely advanced effects. Do you still like the old ways, or have you been converted to the new computers?
I haven't been converted, no. Why? I find the 21st century is not my cup of tea. The 20th century was quite impressive. And early Hollywood, you know, they don't... The meaning of the word star doesn't mean the same as it used to.
But in your movies, the monsters were the stars.
They weren't monsters. They were creatures, misunderstood creatures.
I'm sorry to misinterpret them there. Is that you? Are you the misunderstood creature?
No, I'm misunderstood many times. Our pictures were ignored by the Academy and various other... And, of course, you're always subject to criticism. But I learned in the early days that no matter what you do, you're criticized. Somebody will come out of the woodwork and criticize. So you can't make what would be called the perfect picture.
It must be very gratifying at the end of your career to be recognized by a younger generation here in Edinburgh. So many young filmmakers are coming to see you and congratulate you and listen to your wisdom over the period. Does that give you an extra thrill?
Yes, it does. Of course it does. I'm grateful that they're admired. They've pacified three or four generations. And that's more than you can say with some A pictures. We were considered B picture makers because we had to do it on a tight budget. And those were always used to be considered B pictures. But our pictures have lasted. And the so-called A pictures that cost maybe 10, 15 times more than our films, Jason and the Argonauts, just cost a little over $1 million. And yes, and the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad only cost $650,000, and the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms cost $200,000.
Do you have a favorite of all your models that you made and that you designed, or that you made your father design? I mean, my personal one is probably the Medusa, I have to say.
You liked her. She was rather evil.
That's how I like my women. What do you want?
No, I can't have a favorite because the others get jealous.
And you've got them all still? I mean, you brought the skeleton with you today. Where are the rest of all the wonderful maquettes that you made?
Some are in Germany, and some I have at home. And they've been on various museums, and we're trying to keep the collection together.
At home, where do you keep them, in your house?
In London, I have in my office. I don't want to say just where. Don't ask me my address.
No, I just wondered if you go around to yours for dinner, you could open a cupboard and there would be the Medusa staring at you or the saber-toothed tiger.
Well, no. Some are in Berlin, as I say, at the museum.
Do you have a relationship with these models? Do you talk to them in the way that people, you know, talk to them?
When I close the door in my office, I never know what goes on after we go to bed.
Do you dream of battles and darkness?
I dream of fat pink cupids.
Ray Harryhausen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
A huge thanks to a huge legend, Ray Harryhausen, there, and to all my guests on this special Edinburgh Festival edition of Film Weekly. We'd love to hear from you, of course. If you've been at the festival and discovered a gem or two that have escaped my radar, you can post your reviews and your thoughts on our blog at guardian.co.uk/blogs, or email us at film.weekly@observer.co.uk. But from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, yes, the two Jasons, both of our parents were clearly big Ray Harryhausen fans. Who isn't? It's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.